A few weeks ago, during a sermon about storytelling, I mentioned an anxiety I used to have about not being smart enough to be a minister. And bless your hearts, so many of you told me afterwards that I could be assured that intellectual prowess and the typical markers of it, a PhD, books, scholarly articles, were not, in fact, necessary to be a good minister, which was very sweet of you, so thank you. And I completely agree. I have come to that agreement, just as I agree with the assessment now in connection with just about any field, particularly in the field we are all in together of discovering how to live a good, moral, spiritually rich life. But it did take me a while to figure that out. Entering into ministry, I was so worried about all the things I did not know. I am going to get schooled, I told my friends and family with a nervous laugh before I left for seminary. I did. I spent 4 years and tens of thousands of dollars learning all about theology, history, and ethics, filling my mind with new facts and information I never knew before, only to discover by the end of the experience that I was still clueless. I still knew nothing. The chuckles I'm hearing suggest that you can relate. Yes? Whatever field you're in, the more you learn, the less you know, right? The more you learn, the more questions you have, the more questions open up, and the less confident you are, after all, in what you previously believed to be true. Which got me thinking about knowledge recently and what it really means, how it's related to truth and wisdom. Wisdom is our theme for the month of March, so we'll be exploring it from a few different angles, but I wanted to start here. What is the difference between knowledge, understanding, and wisdom? As a child growing up in Duluth, one of my favorite things to do in the summertime was to watch the huge ocean-going ships go in and out of the harbor underneath the aerial lift bridge. Have any of you been up there and seen that? A few of you? On nice evenings, my family would all go down to the lake and watch and wait. The anticipation built as the ships got closer, and then the excitement really began when the big boats blared their deep, bellowing salute, and the lift bridge operator replied by sounding a slightly higher-pitched but just as loud note of welcome. And all the kids would run down to the water right under the bridge to watch it go up and down around the huge ships. I just took it for granted that ships that big could make it that far inland. It was just simply a part of the way of life in Duluth, and it still is. In fact, it's so much a part of the culture and so beloved that every spring, usually sometime in April, the arrival of the first ocean-going ship, or salty, as they're called around the Great Lakes, is met by the mayor in a very traditional celebration every year. So perhaps it's obvious that I am a lover of the Great Lakes. So of course, I jumped at the chance to go to a spiritual retreat in the UP on Lake Michigan this past October. Many of you may remember that I had spent some time up in the UP. But I was expecting to have sort of like a simple, peaceful experience. What I ended up having was an eye-opening, troubling experience because I started to learn more about the history of the lakes. And I was amazed at how much I didn't know. And I discovered just how much we as a species don't understand about the wisdom of nature. So I asked my parents about this, if they knew some of the history of the Great Lakes, and it turns out they didn't. So I'm amazed that I was unaware of how they were developed. The Great Lakes were never connected to the Atlantic Ocean before human beings forced it to be so, in a series of moves that took immense knowledge and expertise. So here's how it happened in brief. This is what I've been learning. The Welland Canal opened in 1829, bypassing Niagara Falls to connect Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. The Sioux Locks opened in 1855, allowing ships to bypass the St. Mary's River and travel into Lake Superior. And the St. Lawrence Seaway opened in 1959, finally connecting the Great Lakes to the Atlantic Ocean. If you were alive in the mid-20th century, you may remember this moment with all of its pomp and circumstance. You also may remember how much industrial abuse this new canal system propagated. By the 1960s, the rivers and lakes in the Great Lakes system were so polluted that the Cuyahoga River caught fire in 1969. Does anyone remember that? This moment inspired Dr. Seuss to write his 1971 classic, The Lorax. And the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972 in response to this environmental catastrophe. And it did a lot of good work, largely curbing industrial pollution. But unfortunately, it didn't go far enough. For the canal system opened the Great Lakes up not only to industry, but also to biological organisms from the rest of the world. Regrettably, the Clean Water Act did not address this issue. And of particular consequence, it exempted the purification of ballast water from ocean-going vessels into the Great Lakes. The rationale at the time was there's no oil or acid, no pollution in ballast water, so it's just seawater, right? What's the trouble with letting ships flush their ballast in, say, the middle of Lake Erie? Well, what they didn't know or didn't choose to see was that there was another form of pollution lurking in the water, living pollution. Ballast water contains life, and every time it's released, it discharges unknown amounts of biological creatures into the ecosystem. Today, as a result, the Great Lakes are home to 186 non-native invasive species. Perhaps the most devastating invasive species to arrive so far in the Great Lakes has been the zebra and the quagga mussels. These mussels, first discovered in Lake St. Clair, which connects Lake Huron to Lake Erie in 1988, have no natural predators in North America. Dan Egan, author of The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, describes the invasion like this. In less than 20 years, the mussels went from novel find to the lake's dominant species. Sandy beaches still rim the lakes, but if Lake Michigan, for example, were drained, it would now be possible to walk across almost the entire 100 miles between Wisconsin and Michigan on a bed of trillions of filter-feeding quagga mussels. They blanket the entire Great Lakes. Sounds pretty bad, right? I wish I could say that the mussels were contained in the Great Lakes, but I can't. Thanks to the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. Does anybody know about that? You do! This is great news for me, because I didn't, and I was so shocked to find out that I didn't know this. Here's what I've been learning about this year. The city of Chicago was built on a giant swamp, right on top of a largely unrecognized continental divide between the Great Lakes watershed and the Mississippi River Basin. And for thousands of years, one side of the swamp drained into a river ending in Lake Michigan, and the other side drained into a river on its way to the Great Mississippi. But as the city of Chicago grew, they encountered a problem. They were draining their city sewage into the river that ended up in Lake Michigan, which is also where they were getting their drinking water. So they created the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, digging a 6-foot-deep canal that literally reversed the flow of the Chicago River, connecting the Great Lakes with the Mississippi River Basin. To this day, the city of Chicago flushes its waste across the Continental Divide into the Mississippi watershed, siphoning away 6 billion gallons of water per day out of Lake Michigan, essentially creating a superhighway for invasive species to spread all across North America. The Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal has turned the ballast water problem of the Great Lakes into a national problem. Invasive mussels have made their way all across the country, across the Mississippi River Basin, all the way out west to Utah, Nevada, California, where they're clogging up hydroelectric dams, drinking water systems, and irrigation networks. So as I was learning about all this year, I had a new appreciation for those moments when I was a child watching the ocean-going ships come in and out. On the one hand, I was in awe of the people who spent lifetimes developing the knowledge and the expertise to make a feat like that possible. But on the other hand, I was starting to wonder, Was it wise? How can human knowledge and supposed advancement churn out such mixed, devastating results? And where do we go now from here? So before we continue, let us not forget that the people who developed the Great Lakes were people of their time, just like we are. They couldn't predict the future any more than we can. They didn't know what we know today. And I know for sure that something we are doing right now is going to look completely foolish to our descendants. I don't know what it is, but everyone is of their time. But for me, this example did point out some interesting insights around knowledge and wisdom. And here's what I think I've come to. Knowledge is basic facts and information about the world around us. The Chicago River flows into Lake Michigan. Knowledge. Understanding is the ability to connect and make sense out of all this information. The Chicago River is part of a larger interdependent ecosystem. Understanding. Wisdom is the ability born out of experience to act sensibly on that understanding. Perhaps it would be best not to reverse the Chicago River and disrupt an entire ecosystem. Knowledge is constantly updated, enhanced, and built upon to be passed on in a body of knowledge and information to the next generation. Think of science and math. Each generation receives more from the previous. Wisdom across the ages stays the same. Think about philosophy and religion. Think about the constant truth. Wisdom cannot simply be passed on to the next generation. It has to be rediscovered within each generation, within each self. Knowledge provides answers and beliefs. It holds still. You can give it to someone else. Wisdom produces questions and doubts. It moves and seeks. You can point to it, but you can't possess it. Or as author and physician Martin Fisher once said, knowledge is a process of piling up facts. Wisdom lies in their simplification. Which sounds kind of strange to the modern ear, because there is such a strong impulse in America for us to pile on all the information, all the facts, and to prove we are wise because we know all of the things, right? But perhaps wisdom is more about subtraction than addition. Perhaps it's more a process of curation and careful sorting than of accumulation. Perhaps a wise person does not have all the answers, but is someone working to release all the answers. Perhaps all of this is why the Sufi poet Hafiz once wrote, "The beloved sometimes wants to do us a great favor. Hold us upside down and shake all the nonsense out." Our task on our way to wisdom is to shake out all the nonsense, to go through all the facts and data points in our information age, 24-hour news, everything possible world, whittle it down to some bit of understanding, and then discern a right course of action without the nonsense. Just be sure you don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, because we do need knowledge to be wise. As Toni Morrison wrote, we move from data to information to knowledge to wisdom. And if we agree that purposeful progression exists, then you will see that it's easy, it's seductive, to assume that data is really knowledge, or that information is indeed wisdom, or that knowledge can exist without data, and how easy and how effortlessly one can parade and disguise itself as another, and how quickly we can forget that wisdom without knowledge, wisdom without any data, is just a hunch. We need data, information, and knowledge. Lord knows we have enough of that right now. But our cautionary note is not to conflate all that information with wisdom, which again is the ability born out of experience to act sensibly. It's been a hard week. I know a lot of us are scared right now. There's the coronavirus, economic anxiety, election anxiety, and so much more to worry about. So given what we know, given the facts, given our understanding of the world right now, how are we going to act? What is wisdom calling us to do? Clarissa Estes, author of Women Who Run with the Wolves and fellow Great Lakes lover, suggests this. "My friends, do not lose heart," she says. "We were made for these times." One of the most calming and powerful actions you can do to intervene in a stormy world is to stand up and show your soul. To display the lantern of soul in shadowy times like these, to be fierce, to show mercy towards others, both are acts of immense bravery and greatest necessity. "I too have felt despair many times in my life," she says, "but I do not keep a chair for it. I will not entertain it. It is not allowed to eat from my plate. The reason is this. In my uttermost bones, I know something, as do you. It is that there can be no despair when you remember why you came to Earth, who you serve, and who sent you here. When a great ship is in a harbor and moored, it is safe. There can be no doubt. But that is not what great ships were built for. We were made for these times. We are interconnected and strong like never before. We are smart. We have information. But more than that, we are compassionate, tenacious, and brave. Wisdom is calling us to breathe, pay attention, remember the wisdom born out of our past experience that lives in our bones. Discern right action and keep going. Back in Lake Michigan, there's at least one sign of hope that I wanted to share with you. The whitefish population, utterly decimated by the mussel invasion, is starting to bounce back. Whitefish are evolving right before our very eyes to be able to eat the invasive mussels. Fishermen and fisherwomen have been watching this for the last few decades. And at first, the fish were having a hard time digesting them, but they've watched as the fish have been slowly, gradually developing stronger and stronger stomach muscles. So now you can see they have this big kind of beefy rib cage, which allows their stomachs to grind down the mussel shells so they can eat them. The wisdom of nature, timeless and always true everywhere, persists. Wise and gentle people, be not afraid, for we were made for these times. Beneath all the crowded news feeds and information overload lies the wisdom of the ages. Shake out all the nonsense and you will find it. Listen to the earth and all of creation, our partners in right action, and you will hear it. May we respond joyfully to this ancient call. May we move bravely and compassionately forward into whatever may come. May this be so.